It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. As public outcry continues in the wake of the police killings of Michael Brown in Ferguson and Eric Garner in New York, there are lingering questions. In both Ferguson and Staten Island, local prosecutors took the cases before local grand juries, and in both situations, the jurors declined to indict the police officers involved in the killings. But people all over the country, and here in Pittsburgh, of course, are trying to come to grips with the use of deadly force by police, particularly as it's applied to African-American men, and what obligation police have to make sure the use of deadly force is proportional. I'm joined now in Studio A by someone who understands both sides of this question, former Pittsburgh police officer Sheldon Williams, who is African-American. He currently serves on the Citizens Police Review Board and was a panelist for our forum on police community relations back in October. He currently serves as an administrative pastor at the Allegheny Alliance Church on the North Side. And Sheldon Williams, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
It's good to be here, Paul. Thanks for the invitation.
As a former police officer and a member of the African-American community, what has it been like for you to watch the events unfold in Ferguson and Staten Island and the subsequent grand jury decisions?
You know, there are a lot of times where I'm conflicted because I think it's important for people to verbalize their disdain and, their disappointment as to some of the actions that are happening. And so I think those incidents have allowed conversations to occur, and I think that's appropriate. But as we drill down on what happened in Ferguson and what also happened in New York, we have these dividing lines that occur because some people believe that the actions of the police officers were so over the top and unreasonable, and those in law enforcement might view that differently. And so when you extrapolate out of those incidents what actually happened, it takes a careful view to be able to analyze these, to get understanding of what happened so that we could be better moving forward. So as I view that, I certainly can see where protest and disappointment could emerge because there are longstanding issues that are involved with our communities and our policing. But the broad brush paint these incidents as ones that occur all the time and every time would be unfair. So do we need to give credit to where certain situations arise, and you need to evaluate those so we can make policing better and police community relationships better, but also not just assume through some cases that all cases are following suit, because then we'll end up with a divide in our country where people who are responsible for maintaining order and to protect our citizens, and they're trying to do that, and people not understanding what that actually, how that all entails. So to try to bring some sort of understanding to this, I think it's a crucial time for us to have conversations, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk today. But we got to have those conversations and not just lurk in the shadows of the unknown. We got to bring this to light to get understanding.
From the information that you've been able to gather, Sheldon, as far as you are concerned, should the deaths of Michael Brown and Eric Garner, two unarmed black men killed by white police officers, have been prevented?
You know, it's very disturbing for the result to be what it is, given what we know about Michael Brown and for Garner. Because of Garner, we see the video that a lot of people can actually make their own judgment. Michael Brown, we just have testimony from witnesses and the officer. But when I say disturbing because of the reasons for the police action initially seems to be so minimal, and then the result is the lives of these individuals being taken. So, and that's where we get a lot of the varying viewpoints and the sentiment that we see. So the disturbing part of it is you would like to think that when deadly force is used, that there is an apparent, very obvious justification for that. And we can readily get to that justification when we see that there's marked evidence of either assaultive behavior or some presence of a weapon. Absent of that, people have a harder time to say you get to that decision. But in between there are a lot of things that the normal citizen may not be familiar with, that officers might understand differently, that allows them to get to those decision-making processes. And so when we evaluate that, we want to see the appropriateness that ends in that result of termination of a life. in Michael Brown's case, what was said about the officer being assaulted and his behavior, we're getting that in the testimony of the officer. And that reasonableness standard that's applied is applied based off of U.S. Supreme Court decision-making. It says that the objective reasonableness, Tennessee v. Garner, the objective reasonableness of in Graham v. Connor, the two major cases, how does a person view this? And the person that you have to view it is in the reasonableness standard of a reasonable officer's perspective. So given those facts that are laid out, you can't say that, you know, previous malicious thought or intent doesn't play. It's the facts and circumstances presented to that officer at the time. How did he make those decisions? And every evaluating person looking at that has to be a reasonable officer making reasonable decisions at that time, given the facts that are known to him. So that's how we somewhat get these divides, because an officer say, if I'm being assaulted, as he described it, Mr. Wilson, Officer Wilson, had described it.
In Ferguson.
That as he described it, the assaultive behavior and what was happening and the weapons things, whether people believe or not, the reasonable standards applied there. And so, you know, when we look at it, does it actually reach that? And, you know, if you were to ask me my opinion on this case, I'd like to not second guess the actions, but I look at it from a telling someone to get on the sidewalk to termination of life is a huge jump, and something bad happened here. And for me to try to understand what has happened here, I really, really drill down and try to understand it, because it's such a huge leap just from telling an individual to get on the sidewalk. And I think that's a lot of problems that people have in our society. You know,
I'm going to ask you to tap into your gut feelings here, and I'm going to ask you the question that a lot of people are asking about the cases involving Michael Brown and Eric Garner. Would they be alive if they were white?
You know, there is a aspect of threat analysis, and, you know, we have to – let's just be real – and I'm
threat analysis by the officers and the threat that they perceive to them.
To them. But I think every individual assesses threat in their environment, everyone. And so when we say that, you know, if we're looking at these situations, if you're making a comparison, would they be white? Disproportionately, we see these incidents arising between white officers and people of color in the community as to either maltreatment, mistreatment, or some element of disrespect that is asserted. And so there is credence to that. I mean, you have to look at, if these incidents repeatedly keep coming up, then why are they happening and at what level? So there is a perspective that people hold as they approach certain individuals that starts them down the decision-making process. And that's what I'm talking about, threat analysis. And so if that threat analysis, if I'm being impacted by information I'm getting, whether it's through media or my lack of ability to really make individuals tangible, and I'm just making my decisions based on preconceived notions and not establishing those to be true, individuals who perceive certain people certain ways will not act differently whenever they're in face of a threat before them. They have started down that pathway long before the actual action had happened.
So you're saying that whatever an individual who happens to be a police officer believes in their own home, they're going to take with them out onto the street.
Exactly. Those threat analysis or you know, when I say threat, you know, let me distinguish that if I perceive people differently, whether I'm working or not, and this is a societal thing, not just a law enforcement thing, that if I perceive people in a certain way, I'm not going to act contrary to that when I'm faced with that individual. I'm pulling on those experiences or those perceptions that are guiding my decision making. So if it's a thing where I start categorizing people equally, lumping them up, making these notions about them, it's not going to change when I'm coming into interaction with that individual. It's actually going to be supported when I'm making the action with them. So I say that if you want to open up, and it's not that somebody, let's divide out people who purposely target individuals because they look a certain way or they act a certain way. There's a distinction to be made that individuals who are purposely going to go and target certain individuals just based on the color of their skin, there is a segment of individuals who would do that. But if I don't have good foundation of being relational with various amounts of people, only thing that I could rely on is what I think about that individual, and it may not be well firmly rooted in a good foundation, then I'm operating with bad foundation. So when I'm in this life-threatening or in a split-second decision-making process, I am already starting down a pathway, a threat analysis that I have already began, that started before the incident. And so if I'm making sense where I'm going with the whole perspective aspect, you got to open up people's perspectives about individuals that allows them to pull from different resources to make reasonable decisions. That's that level of threat. So you could start assessing threats differently if I see people differently. So that's where the disparity comes up. And some people would, you know, I was recently at a forum and people asked about this thing that we call white privilege. And some people understand what white privilege is or not. And some people agree or disagree. And my statement to them was, how do I categorize white privilege? Is that in our society, if I'm a white individual, I have to prove that I'm a bad white. If I'm an African American, I got to prove that I'm a good black. And so if people hold that viewpoint, and it's happening a lot, that there's a whole lot more opportunity to show if you're certain you have a certain look versus the automatic assumption if you have another look. And then that has to be dismissed. But that exists in our society today.
Our guest is former Pittsburgh police officer Sheldon Williams here on Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. If you would like to join our conversation, if you have a comment or a question for Mr. Williams, 412-246-2002 is the number to call, 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh, hashtag EPLive. What is important for people to know about what police are trained to do?
Sure. First of all, there are three things that police officers are required to do when they're on a scene, called to a scene, or in the course of their duties. It's to maintain control, regain control, or gain control. So gain, maintain, or regain. And so when you look at it from a control aspect, officers who are there, they're trying to make sure that things are individuals have a safe environment in which to live and work and to just be present in, and if they have to ensure that, because that's their job. Now, anything that allows, that invades or doesn't provide them the opportunity to do that, they will then make steps to ensure that. So that control aspect. And so officers look at that and they assess that for the safety of all, make sure that order is maintained. And so that is actually when we talk about the thin blue line that some don't really understand, but the thin blue line is that line of officers between chaos and order. And so people think the thin blue line is this group of individuals who will stand together no matter what. It's actually the line between chaos and order. And officers hold and embrace that responsibility. And if they would, and that's that whole control aspect. So when things somewhat may not be in control, they use certain tactics or efforts to regain that control. That's what an officer's goal is in every situation, is to make sure that there's order in our society.
Let's look at Eric Garner then, because we've all seen that video. Mm-hmm. And there he is. He's selling loose cigarettes on the street. And he's being approached by an officer and then another, and then backup arrives. And when you watch that video, what are you seeing there, and where does it go wrong?
Yes. First step is the verbal noncompliance on the part of Mr. Garner, that the officers are telling him about some law enforcement action, however minimal, you know, to selling the cigarettes illegally. And, you know, it seems like a small thing, but they're telling him about that. So the verbal noncompliance is the first step. And so that level of activity then allows officers to make certain other decisions. And so that's how it got progressive. We went from verbal noncompliance. And my viewing of that, many people say he didn't resist arrest. He didn't, you know, he was just standing up for his rights. And all I'm saying, and I think that the situation was very bad. It's unfortunate he lost his life. the chokehold, I would categorically say that I would not support the use of that chokehold in that instance.
What could the officers have done differently? Could they have used other means to subdue him, like a taser or a stun gun?
If those equipment options are available, it could have been used. But in a continuum of force, the officer needs to make the reasonable decision to use the force depending on what he's being presented with. It's not like a step-by-step process. We use a continuum of force here in Pittsburgh. But they have to be justified in what acts they should have been able to use. What they did was, if there was a taser, yes, it would have probably been better to use the taser versus them. But you have multiple officers. And so that level of force could have been the appropriate level of force by sitting there either using some sort of joint manipulation or trying to control him in some manner. But they could have done those tactics and could have displayed those a little bit differently. So it doesn't mean that automatically they should have pepper sprayed, then taser, then use hard hand techniques. They have to make that decision based on the circumstances that are presented before them.
We're talking with former Pittsburgh police officer Sheldon Williams about the continued public outcry and reaction in the wake of the police killings of Michael Brown and Eric Garner and the lingering questions that have followed the decisions by grand juries not to press charges against police involved in those incidents. We're talking with a former Pittsburgh police officer, Sheldon Williams, who is African-American. He is a member of the Citizens Police Review Board, and we're taking your calls at 412-246-2002. We'll try to jam as many as we can in here in the last 10 minutes, starting with John. And John, where are you calling from?
Yes, hello?
Yes, John, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from the road over here on the parkway.
Okay, all right, go ahead with your comment or question.
The question I have is, I was in this conversation concerning this, and I'd like to address this to ex-officer Williams. An existing assistant district attorney made this comment that some police officers are bullies, and his comment was, if they weren't on the police force, they'd be in jail. That's a direct quote. And my personal experience has been that police officers and security personnel seem to, on occasion, instead of defusing situations, they escalate the aggressive nature of a situation. I would like the officer to comment on the screening process for officers to get rid of people with aggressive and bully-type personalities.
Great question, John.
Yeah, that is a beautiful question. First of all, there has to be progressive discipline. If you're talking about if these individuals are currently employed in police departments and they exhibit these behaviors, and let's qualify that bullying type of aggressive behavior you're saying. And so that would be a negative for the police department because this person's characteristic would not be helpful for the situation. So that's a progressive discipline. If you see these behaviors, it should be documented, spoken to, and that whole aspect of progressively disciplining, either for behavior modification or future termination of that individual. That should not be supported, and individuals in that department should be doing things to counter that. But on a screening process, any person who exhibits those behaviors or those characteristics, there is a toughness that is a characteristic. We do need an element of toughness because of the things we're asking officers to do. But toughness is not size, bulk, or muscle. Toughness is both internal and external, the ability to stand with confidence to be able to do the duties that they're called to do. It could be a small framed 110-pound female, or it could be a 250-pound gentleman. The toughness we need is to stand up, uphold the law in the appropriate manner, treat people with respect and dignity, and be able to do your duties without moving to these old personal things of what you describe bullying, a personal characteristic that is not characteristic of what we want of our police officers.
Do police have to be trained differently, do you think?
We have to train them with threats and to assess threats and to assess those appropriately. They do need training. I mean, just like the military, there's a de-civilianizing aspect of the military when they go to boot camp to train them as soldiers. Similarly, a paramilitary type grouping like policing, we do the same thing to think in a way of police officers. And so because that individuals, they may be called to make split-second decisions, be able to protect others, looking at the dangers that are involved with the job, they have to be able to act and act appropriately. And so we do have to train them to be mentally prepared to be able to deal with this. But with that, it is a whole element of training that comes alongside that helps them pull resources to make those decisions appropriately. We don't want individuals walking around in type of gangster style behavior where we're just running into to certain situations and using force without justification. When justification of force is necessary, those officers have an ability to process that appropriately so that they would do the appropriate action based off of the empowerment of the citizens entrusting them to do those duties.
So you're saying that there's an obligation on the part of the police to make sure that the use of force is proportional?
Yeah, the use of force proportional to the level of threat that is presented to them and justified based off of what those actions that they are doing. The justification comes based off of what they assess at the moment to be able to bring order to that situation and to do it quickly and safely enough. Even safety for the individual, even in the use of force. People think even though there's a possibility of injury that can result from the use of force, it is the mechanism that brings that situation to a close in the safest, most possible way, even if it can inflict injury. And so many people don't understand, well, if you're hurting somebody, how is that safe? It's doing it in the safest manner. So if it's hard hand techniques or baton use or even up to deadly force, you have to use that based on the decision-making process what's being presented to do it in the safest, most effective way.
Is enough being done, though, to keep someone like Eric Garner alive?
Yeah, well, the thing about, you know, that situation, if you could have done a bird's eye view of that situation, I believe if those officers had to reevaluate, not just with the outcry and deploying those tactics, I think if they looked at it, could things have been done better? We can always Monday morning quarterback actions. And so on that scene, given what was happening, another officer taking a bird's eye view and seeing this individual struggling, could it be as he's struggling and resisting because he doesn't want to go to jail, or is there something physically or physiologically happening with him with this whole pile-on thing? That could have happened differently, and I will personally tell you that it has happened in my career where we have had to take somebody in control who was assaultive and was assaultive towards the police officers, and when you had a mass amount of officers trying to get control of him, one of us had to be able to at least take a bird's eye view and make sure that we do it in the safest manner because we were putting a lot of bodies on top of the individual, and we did it safely. Get him under control, get him cuffed, and be able to take him away. So it takes that second look to look at and make sure we're assessing the totality of this whole thing and make sure that we're doing it in the safest way.
And I want to take another call here, but I would be remiss if I didn't bring up the Leon Ford case.
Mm-hmm.
A black motorist shot and paralyzed from the waist down in a case of mistaken identity. The police thought he was somebody else. What, if anything, could have been done differently by the Pittsburgh police in that case?
You know, that situation, you know, as I've reviewed that tape, that went on for an extended period of time. The officers who were there were trying their best they had suspicion that he might have been somebody other than who he was, and they were trying to resolve that. There was a long period of time where there was total compliance on a part of Leon Ford and the officers. You can see it in their body action. When they could not resolve that, you know, that this was not who he said he was, then that's when those moments just took a turn for what they did. Doing things differently, you had to look at the totality of the situation. Was the arrest of the individual at that moment so overbearing that we had to go to these levels of force? Those officers articulated their actions at the moment. And when, you know, looking at it from a Monday morning quarterbacking situation, that here you have this individual who has support, that he is who he is, I would have to look at that, and it would weigh heavy on me to say that there's more evidence here than not that he is who he says he is. And so when they made the decision to go in and make an arrest, which was a quick decision to do so, that's when this thing escalated to the point that it did. And the gentleman resulted in the condition he's in. You know, looking back on that and the whole plan that went forward to take him in arrest, they could have, you know, there's some tactics that could have been used differently. And if they were going to utilize those, the Pittsburgh Police Department is taught how to do felony car stops. They're taught how to do that in a safer manner. Rushing to the car probably was not the best decision to make, and they could have used those tactics differently. And I think that was supported even in the internal review of those actions.
We can take a call from Leslie if you go quick. Leslie, you've got about 15 seconds.
Hello.
Hi.
I just want to commend Mr. Williams for appearing and offering an alternative view. My quick question is, how do we know the information that was given to the grand jury in Ferguson was true? And how do we know that Officer Wilson was giving the correct information and not tailoring it.
Let's let him answer it, Leslie. Good question. I don't know if you can answer that or not. And
you know,
a few
all
seconds.
We can go is the best system that we have, and there probably are flaws with that. Thank you for asking that question. So the jury can only be able to assess the evidence that's before them, and if they made that decision based off of what they've seen, we have to trust that they had the best information before them.
Former Pittsburgh police officer Sheldon Williams, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.